Hello and welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we provide shortcuts to excellence by dispensing wisdom, not just information or mere fact, to an international audience of rising leaders. My name is Duff Watkins and I'm your host. This podcast is sponsored by Professional Development Forum, which helps young professionals of any age accelerate their performance in the modern workplace. On this podcast, you'll hear honest, practical advice that you can't find in any book. And that's because it took 50 years to learn these lessons. Today's guest is Michael Kelly, who transforms leaders into master communicators. Michael has been doing this in Australia for about 150 years. Okay, no, I just made that up. It just seems that way because he works with all the major banks, all the pharmaceutical companies, all the senior executives in so many industries. In fact, I can't turn on the TV, pick up a magazine or a newspaper without seeing him being quoted because he's the go-to guy in Australia. Anytime they want a critique of the prime minister's performance or a U.S. presidential candidate's debate performance, he's the guy they go to. So we're going to go to him too. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Duff.
I was on your website today. You have a quotation that says, every time you speak, you're auditioning for leadership. And I thought, why didn't Michael tell me 50 years ago? I could have used that then. I happen to know, I've known you for a long time. I happen to know you didn't start out as a master communicator. You started out as a speech therapist and then made the transition into business. So I have two questions for you. The first is, What was your first lesson in business?
Yeah, great question. I started out in the 90s, Duff, and I was a speech pathologist. And my lesson was this: I should have worked for a company in the presentation training industry before I started my own business, hung out my own shingle. The thing was, I was a speech pathologist. I knew about voice. I was at a high level. What I was not a high level in was in running a business. And I would have shaved many years off my trajectory of my business and career if I had gone to work for a company such as Rogan. I don't know if you know that name.
They were there.
And I could have worked for them, but I think I was just a bit too haughty. So I should have done my time and learned about business, which is, I know now, but then I was a lot of really things I could have learned from other people.
You know, it's funny. My version of that is if kids ask me when they're in university, what should they study? Actually, Michael, nobody ever asks me that. But if they do, I have this answer prepared for them. I would say, whatever you study, whatever you major in, study that, but also study business, because probably in your life, you'll end up in business. And as you know, business is a cauldron, a bubbling cauldron of wants and passions and desires and livelihoods. So that lesson certainly resonates with me. Okay, question number two. What have you unlearned? And by that I mean something that you absolutely positively knew to be true then, but now no, is not correct at all. And you wonder how you could have thought that in the first place.
And again, that goes to the beginning of business, where I heard all these motivational speakers says, recite mantras and you will succeed in business. So I would recite these mantras and nothing happened. And what I learned was the universe rewards action. So if you think that just reciting these mantras and you're going to be successful, that's where it's very dangerous. And I don't believe that now. I like mantras, but if it's not paired with action, that's where the danger is. So what do they say? Professionals just show up and get to work. They don't need inspiration. So I don't believe the mantras, the book, The Secret.
I'm proud to say I have not read it, nor will I, but
no,
yes,
I know.
That, of course you haven't. I would be disappointed if you had read it, Michael.
Just get on, do the work, take action. So I guess to sum up, mindless mantras, I've given up and I don't believe.
Yeah, good. Well, it's I think the psychological phrase for it is magical thinking.
And
we're all prone to it, by the way. I mean, that's why the popularity of such books and I mean, no one is immune. Not me, not you, not anybody.
But. That's right.
All right, 10 lessons it took you 50 years to learn. I have a little list here. So the first one, you say every person is fighting a battle that I know nothing about. How can this be? How can I not know anything about a person?
Well, this comes from a friend of mine, and why it made an impact on me. I run a lot of workshops. I do a lot of one-on-one training. And when I run a workshop, a group workshop, I sit in the audience. And I imagine that I'm a participant. And I think, what would I like from the person at the front of the room? And what am I bringing to this workshop that has nothing to do with improving my communication? Mm-hmm. Money problems, health problems, family problems, relationship problems, work problems. Maybe they lost their phone last night. And then I think, okay, if I was bringing all that, what would I want from the person at the front of the room? Well, know their stuff well. Take themselves less seriously, take what they do seriously. And I shared this with one of my Commonwealth Bank executives who needs to take beta blockers before he presents, and he presents a lot.
To lower the anxiety.
Exactly. And he had to present a lot. And he said, you know, Michael, now I do sit in the audience, realize that everyone is fighting battles just like me. And that has calmed me down and has lessened my use of these drugs, which can be dangerous. And he was taking them. Many every day, and that's where the danger was.
Yeah, taking drugs just to get through the day. It there is a saying, it's been attributed to many people, but it's be kind to everyone, for they are carrying a heavy burden. And the point is, you can't see the burden, you don't know what the burden is, and that's what your first point struck me. Point number two, you say have great respect for high intelligence and culture. But
never stand in amazement of it. And this comes from Abraham Lincoln, former U.S. president. So Lincoln, and it just struck me. So no matter who I interact with, I have great respect for their intelligence, for their culture, for their expertise, but I'm never fawning and never, oh, you're so great. And I think that's what you need to do, particularly in the corporate world. You know, leaders, there's a lot of leaders that shouldn't be deified. Jeffrey Pfeffer, Stanford, you may know of his work. Great article, Why the Assholes Are Winning, Money Trumps All. And money, you can do virtually anything and get away with it if you are sufficiently rich and sufficiently powerful. So my point is that no matter who you're interacting with, sure, respect their intelligence, but don't deify them, and with realize that these executives, some of them don't deserve respect, and you should watch them and see if their actions match their behaviors.
Well, as a performance coach of many years, yeah, amen, brother. Now, okay, and you don't need moral fiber to make money. We know that. Now, my question is, how or when did you learn that?
Yeah, I read a lot, like you, Duff, and I just read a book about Lincoln and people, what they said about him. And, you know, they say he was obviously an amazing guy that could hold dualities at the same time. But yeah, probably about 5, 6, 7 years ago, and that really resonated with me. So yeah, I think it's wise advice. And I think too, famous people or whatever, they don't want fawning. They want, just talk to them. You know, don't talk up to them, don't talk down to them, just level with them.
I think one of the observations I made, the fawning and the deification it persists because it works so well with people, unfortunately.
Yeah, it does. And as you know, in the corporate world, there's a lot of politics, and obviously you have to negotiate that. But Pfeffer says, look after yourself, because leaders won't look after you. And understand what gets rewarded in your organization and not rewarded, and then chart your course. That may mean at some point you choose to leave.
Yes,
organization.
Yeah. That is an excellent point. That is realpolitik in the corporate world. And I spend a lot of time telling younger people about that. And because I work in executive search, I say to people, that company that you're so loyal to, so committed to, so that you value so much, they would put you on a street in a heartbeat if it suited them. And they should, because the company needs to survive. That's the most important thing for them. Mm. So, and that's the reality of it. But anyway, that aside, this next point, your next point is one of my personal favorites. All agreements are with yourself, you say. Mm. Tell me more.
Yes, again, I got this a long time ago from Jack Canfield. You may know the name. Mm-hmm. And I listen to, I don't agree with everything he says, but it's true. And what do I mean by that? Well, I'll give an example. I have made an agreement with myself that I will exercise every day. Mm-hmm. So since 2010, I've probably missed no more than 10 or so days. And why is that important? Well, if I do not exercise every day, I would have broken an agreement with myself. And then when I want to do other things, I might see myself as untrustworthy. Mm-hmm. So that's why keep your agreements with yourself. If you say you're going to do something, do it. And then when you think, can I do this or not? Well, I've kept my agreements every day for the last decade in exercise. So very simply that.
Well, the reason why that's so important psychologically is because you are a universe of selves, and there's various, there's a lot of selves in Michael. There's, Michael the father, Michael the husband, Michael the maid, Michael the business guy, Michael, on and on and on. Yes. And they have competing priorities. And when you break an agreement with yourself, basically you are eroding your self-image or your self-esteem in some ways. Now, you're able to negotiate with yourself. In fact, you need to, because you've got all these competing yous inside you. I'm sure there's a part of you that says, not today, Mike. We don't need to go for a run or go to the gym. It's pretty early in the morning. It's cold outside. Oh, is that you? Is that me? Anyway, whatever. But yeah, you have that. People have these internal conversations. The point is to have some sort of consistency and internal discipline, because it's for your benefit. I mean, you go to the gym for your benefit, right? Not for anybody else's.
Definitely. And I don't go to the gym. I don't think you need a gym. I have a routine every morning. I never want to get up at 10 to 6, Duff, during the week, but I do. Mm-hmm. And now the body knows the routine. It just almost moves without, I don't have to think much about it because it knows the movements. Mm-hmm. So that's why. But I do think if you say you're going to do something, we're going to make it onto another point related to that in a moment. Yeah.
Yeah. But the important thing is to not undermine yourself by breaking agreements with yourself.
Indeed.
Okay. Next point, it's a quotation from Kurt Vonnegut, as I happen to recognize. We are what we pretend to be, so therefore.
We must be careful what we pretend to be. And as you may know, it comes from his book, Mother Night. Mm-hmm. And it was about a U.S. double agent in World War II who became a Nazi propaganda minister. The thing was, he forgot he worked for the Americans. He pretended to be this Nazi propaganda minister. So with my clients, what I often say when I'm working with them, I'd say, okay, Duff, if you're my client, you're at this level. For the next 7 days, I want you to pretend that you're at a high level. You don't tell anyone, but start acting, carrying yourself, speaking, listening like you are at the higher level. And then when I email them a week later, I'd say, Duff, how's the pretending going? And then I'll say, if it's going well, keep pretending until you're no longer pretending. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't resonate with anyone, but I had a guy at Caltex, and I asked him,
fuel company, Caltex.
Exactly. Yeah. Actually, it's called Ampol now.
Yeah, that's right.
They
changed
the name here in Australia. But he said, Michael, people are reacting to me differently. I've been pretending for 7 days, and I can feel they're interacting with me in a different way. So I think we should be careful, what we pretend to be. And I think it can be useful. So that's one that has resonated with some of my clients.
It's also a psychological truism. Acting as if is the principle.
Yes.
You know, in the military, that's the way you get promoted. You act, you perform, act, and behave in the rank that you want to be. So if you're a lieutenant, behave like a captain, and then you'll be promoted one to, well, you'll have an opportunity to be promoted to one. But you can't act like a corporal and be promoted to a captain.
And this reminds me of a story of Sidney Pollack, the actor, then he became a director. He since has died, but this is a true story. In, I think it's Warren Bennis's book, he shared this. When Pollack was making the transition from actor to director, he was really nervous. He says, I don't know if I can do that. But then he thought, hold on, I've worked with directors all my life. What do? Well, they get the flak jacket, they get the director's chair, they get the megaphone, they bark out orders. And he said, you know, I'm just gonna act as if. You, great, best boy, Dolly. True story. Sounds like a director. So I think, but I do think, I don't like the phrase fake it till you make it. Because I don't like the word fake, and people confuse those. And I think fake it till you make it is good in the short term. But if you're continually faking it, that's delusion. So act as if. I like that phrase. That's what I use.
Well, since you quote Sidney Pollack, who is an Oscar-winning director, that he went back to acting and before he passed away. But he, I mean, acting is the metaphor that I use, because an actor, a really good actor, they will inhabit a role. I mean, okay, we're in Australia. So, I mean, I remember just seeing him. I was watching a movie, and this woman, this actress was performing as she was inhabiting the character of Virginia Woolf, the English-British writer.
Oh, yes.
And I'm sitting there racking my brains trying to figure, who is this actress? Who is this actress? I could see the Virginia Woolf, but I couldn't see the actress. And of course, it was Nicole Kidman. Now, I mean, I sat across a table from Nicole Kidman, and I still didn't recognize her, because she inhabited the role so thoroughly, so completely, and she won an Oscar for that. Now, and that's my point. People give you awards when you inhabit roles so thoroughly, so comprehensively, so well. And when you're a leader, it's a persona. Persona is a old Greek word for mask. You know, you and you know, this is what you tell people to do. Get up there, act like a leader, speak like a leader, behave like a leader, because that's what people want, need, expect.
Yeah, but I think the distinction is it can't be too different from who you are. It can't be false. So you have to try on some new ways and experiment. And that can be difficult for people. But yeah, I think act as if, how you dress, and it'll get on to another point, I think, later about that.
Well, and that's the point. Be careful who you pretend to be. And the thing that I've learned is no role is beyond you, me, us, anybody listening. Now, some are a stretch, big stretch, and some are simply not worth it. But but you know, you can all do them to varying degrees of success. The question, and I think that's the importance of your point to me, is just be careful what you pretend to be.
Yes.
Point number five, show up on time, do what you say you're going to do, finish what you start. That seems kind of bleeding obvious to me, Michael. What's the wisdom in there?
Yeah, it is. I know. It's at first blush, I would say, Duff. I say this to everyone who wants to go and to do some business deals with me. It's do what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. That's an addition there. I go to people, and you'd be surprised how many people cannot do those things. I have people that come and say, oh, Michael, let's do some business together. I say, sure, send me something. Never heard from them again. And they want me to introduce them to someone. In fact, I'll tell you a story. I was with a recruiter maybe a year or two ago, and I was a little teasingly saying, you know what? Those are my show up on time, do what you say you're going to do, when you say you're going to do it, finish what you start. And I said, you're probably not going to do that. And he said, oh, yes, I will. And guess what? He didn't do that. So it's, you know, I'm surprised. I'm really amazed in this competitive world of business, Duff, that people can't do those things. I'm sure there's emergencies. Sometimes things happen. But that's fundamental to the way I operate my business. And it may seem too simple to be effective, but doing it, it's just like a lot of my technique stuff. They sound simple, and I'll get on to it. Maybe we'll talk about them. But the execution, well executed, or just executing them,
They are simple, but they're significant too, as you're pointing out. And you're quite right. It goes back to your point about what is business? To me, business is keeping your agreements with people. Well, what is a marriage? What is relationships? Keeping your agreements. And if you can't keep the agreement, don't make the bloody thing in the first place. You know, it really is just that simple. Don't enter the agreement. And yeah, I was sort of jesting, but if... You know, your life becomes a lot simpler if you simply keep your agreements first with yourself and secondly with other people. And remember, all those agreements are voluntary. Mm. Nobody makes you go into them.
And I, you know, sometimes you may want to change an agreement. That, you know, things mm-hmm. change. So I think you've just got to speak up and say, look, Duff, I said I was going to do this. I'm not able to do this now, rather than just not contacting you and letting it just melt away. But yeah, I think that's a fundamental one that's paid off for me in my business.
Yeah, and I think you're quite. It is often overlooked. You know, it's so simple, so straightforward, but is often overlooked. And there is a cost to overlooking it. Point number six: complete the task in front of you
with as much excellence and elegance you can bring to it. Again, I like how things are phrased. I like words and how people string them together. This comes from David Allen of Getting Things Done, mm-hmm. Fame. And I heard him on a podcast with Tim Ferriss, and such a down-to-earth guy. And so how does that play out? Well, when I do prepare for a piece of work and I think I've done a good job in preparation, I'll still spend maybe another 15 minutes or so asking myself, how could I make this better? How could I complete this task in front of me with excellence and elegance? And sometimes, as you know, you'll find one or two more ideas to make it sharper, to make it tighter. And, you know, it lines to Jeffrey Gittema's favorite phrase, if you are not on fire, you will lose to someone who is. Mm-hmm. And just to elaborate a bit further, when I help people with pitch coaching, I say, this is a key, very key point, WECID, which stands for what else can I do that my competitors won't do? And most people don't ask that enough, because you know, in competitive business situations, there's very little difference between the winner and second place. Would you like me to share a story about that?
Sure.
So a number of years ago, I think it was in the 90s, advertising pitch. Company was going for $1 million large deal. So they had competitors. They actually won the pitch. So they went back to the CEO who assigned them the business. And they said, why did you give us the business? And this is what the CEO said. Well, you know, we didn't know who to give it to. You were all much the same. But when I drove into your car park for the final presentation, you had erected on a stake my name on a plate for me to park my car. And after I turned off the car, he said, they really want this. That's why you've got the business. Now, could you predict that, Duff? No. But you see, they kept asking the question, what else could we do that our competitors won't do? And what's the difference, Duff, between cheesy and not cheesy? It's through the eyes and ears of the person you're presenting to. So they thought, okay, how would this come across? Yeah, no, we're going to try it out. And most people don't take those risks. So I think that's maybe a line to that excellence. And just as another aside, there was a competitive pitch in the 90s, and the company that get the business, they went, did the same thing. Why don't you give us the business? They said, well, you sent your PowerPoint slide deck before the presentation. And in the 90s, that was really seen as spectacular. So again, just little things.
Yeah. So WECID. What else?
WECID. What else could I do that my competitors? So keep asking. You know, if you keep that revolving around, you might get a lot of the ideas will be not of use. But sometimes you may get a gem, like thinking about that steak in the car park.
We're talking about movies. There is a writer director. Richard Gravenese, I think. I think he did the movie The Fisher King. He said something that reminded me of what you're saying, and because you know when you write a screenplay or when I write a LinkedIn post or an article or publish anything, I know you do draft after draft after draft after draft, and the point that he said is this: there's always a better idea, and if you sit there and think about it long enough and hard enough, you'll find it. You'll find it. And that's been my experience.
Yeah, and Duff, let me give a commendation to you. Your blog posts that you sent, or your LinkedIn posts are fantastic.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's a bit of therapy, bit of fun. You said complete it with as much excellence and elegance as I can bring to it. You can bring. What do you mean by elegance?
Well, there's, sure, excellence, get the result, but how you handle yourself, how the polish, the manner in which you deliver, for me, my information, I think should have some elegance. I think some grace, some class.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's not just hitting you with these ideas. Sure, I've mm-hmm. got all these, but it's maybe how in the manner that you deliver it. I just think about that as well. I think the excellence is the most important, but I think the elegance can be a little extra as well.
Style is not to be despised. You know, people, we like that. People respond to that. Point number 7, maximize the number of positive impressions you leave.
Every time you interact with someone, it forms an impression and a potential for loss or gain. If you maximize the number of positive impressions you leave, you'll maximize your hit rate in getting what you want, whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
In this world of COVID, Duff, I see a lot of CEOs with beards. And sure, we're more casual now. The potential perception is, oh, you were too lazy to shave. Not that you shouldn't have a beard.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't realize what they're signaling with their dress, how they speak, their lack of attention. And as you know, the backgrounds and how they, you know, rushing is junior, owning time is senior. So mm-hmm. if I-
Say that again, because I think that rushing is junior, that's the behavior of a junior person.
Owning time is senior. Mm-hmm. Even if you think you're not rushing, if it's perceived you're rushing.
Uh-huh.
And Duff, in speaking terms, it may be only fractions of a second. So you may know about the presenter's misperception of time. So when mm-hmm. in the speaking spot, time tends to go like this.
Mm-hmm.
But from the audience, it'll go like this.
Mm-hmm.
So the best executives, leaders, they never rush. They take their time. They can be quick, but then they don't hurry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's owning that time. And it's often the beginning of an interaction. And do you know seniority is signaled by response time?
Tell me more.
When you ask me a question, how quickly I respond determines how senior I am.
Mm-hmm.
More senior people take a little bit more time before they start speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And again, not a lot of time. And, you know, I'll go on with a few ideas related to this. When you enter a video meeting like this or a room, radiate warmth and acceptance and calm enthusiasm. When we radiate warmth and acceptance, conversations just seem to flow.
Mm-hmm.
When we enter a room with a level of calm and a level of enthusiasm, we attract people toward us. And you may know about the research of Nalini Ambadi, Harvard University professor, on 2 seconds to a long-term impression. I think a lot of people miss the opening. And, you know, what is the face signaling? As you know, a person is first known by their countenance, this facial expression. A lot of people don't know what this is signaling, particularly when they enter a room. They look a little dazed or distracted.
Mm-hmm.
And CEOs, particularly now with video meetings, need to be aware of what they're signaling.
How important is this, or ought this to be, in a person's life? For example, I mean, I got to tell you, Michael, I don't go around trying to maximize positive impressions. Mm. Of course, that would explain a great deal in my life, by the way, but nonetheless, how concerned should a young up and coming person, how much time should they spend fretting about that?
Yeah, I don't think fretting is the word. Just be aware you're always sending impressions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how you dress, as you know, how you enter a room, what you say, what you don't say. So I think it's overall, that's the overall template, to be aware that some people, you know, like in a meeting, Duff, you know, when you're not speaking, some junior people will say, no one's watching me. Of course they are. A lot of senior people look at a boardroom and around the boardroom, and they might think, oh, who looks like they have something intelligent to say? No. Oh, yes, because they're playing with their hair, or they're playing and doing all these things. That doesn't say you're present, you should be intelligently curious when you're listening. That's mm-hmm. how you should be perceived by the people, and you're there. The other thing I would say, now, just as an aside, for physical meetings, when after you come into a room radiating warmth and acceptance and calm enthusiasm, the acronym is SODA: stop, observe, decide, act. You may know it comes, it's an adaptation of John Boyd. Do you know John Boyd's The OODA Cycle? Anyway, people can research that. He was a military strategist.
I do know John Boyd. Yes, yes.
Yes, yes, quite famous. You may know. But I've made it SODA. I think people come in the room and they keep walking. You should come in the room and stop. Because if you're rushing and you're moving in, that may be perceived as, again, junior. So you stop, observe the situation. You'd say, oh, there's a projector there. I'm not going to sit there. Decide, I'll sit there, then act. And mm-hmm. this may only take a few seconds. Mm-hmm. But I think how you handle your body, and we haven't got even onto body language, how you carry yourself. I like self-possession rather than presence, Duff. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think presence is overused. What do I mean by self-possession? You are in possession of yourself. Mm-hmm. When you speak, when you don't speak. When you move, when you don't move. How you act. And I think that's what you want to develop. In possession of your entire self. Not letting someone else rush you.
I prefer your term too. Self-possession is something that I can do. Presence is something a bit too amorphous. I know I know there are coaches and businesses yes. around yes. establishing presence, but it always has been a bit ethereal to me.
Yes, I agree.
Okay, I'm hanging with you so far on these first seven lessons. Number eight, though, I'm not so sure. You say project energy. That sounds like bullshit to me, Michael. What do you mean by that?
Great. Well, Duff, energy is 70% of a job. If you don't have it, be nice.
If you don't have energy, be nice.
because energy is,
you know, what's plan C? What if I don't have either of those?
Well, you know, people that have no energy and they're not nice.
Yes, I do.
So energy can overcome a lot of foibles. I just remember, just as an aside, I was in a workshop and someone was doing a mock presentation and he was making no sense at all, but I'm still listening to him and I'm thinking, why am I still listening to this person? His energy and his voice and his manner and his face. And you've got to get feedback about that. You know, Duff, your energy is more memorable than your words.
Mm-hmm. So you think the audience remembers the energy more than the
yes.
actual?
Yes. I do. And think of the last 2 weeks. Think of all the words you have spoken. Still, your energy is more memorable than your words. And you know the famous Maya Angelou quote. I think it's something like this: people may forget what you have said, but they will never forget how you made them feel. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think it's aligned to that. And as far as energy, Duff, energy is the secret sauce of video meetings, because this medium sucks energy. So you may, and I have techniques, when I go into them, to get a little bit of sharpness with the energy. For example, think of your voice as a laser, and projecting maybe a little bit beyond the camera in these video meetings. So I think the energy, people don't realize how much they may need to do more, particularly for video meetings, than they think.
Yeah, okay, I'm persuaded. Okay, I got it now, I'm convinced. But number nine, I'm definitely going to argue about this. Project certainty, you say. Now, come on, isn't certainty, isn't that the source of modern evil in the world? Isn't that the trouble with all these pseudo experts and these people asserting certainty when in fact it's nonsense?
Yes, I agree with you totally. It can be used for the dark side. But let me give you my take on it. People will believe your certainty. They may not know if an idea is good or not, but they will believe how certain you are that it is a good idea. Mm-hmm. And to be clear, it's not about bluffing, trying to convince you that I know what I'm talking about when I'm not. But when you're certain, project certainty. Most people who are presenting to a group are domain experts. The person who they're presenting to is not the domain expert. Mm-hmm. And they go on the body language, the voice, the structure, the message, how many words they speak. So, and there's a caveat here, obviously. Say I was the MD, you reported to me. Sometimes, sure, I might say, Duff, we're in a Duff situation, and I might, say, I'm not certain how we'll do this, but I have a plan. So I think when you need to have a plan if you're a leader. But I see a lot of million-dollar deals lost stuff when the person pitching it came across as a bit uncertain when it was clearly the right thing to do. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's where I'm getting at. It's aligning, you know, because people look and they think, is this make sense? So I think it's, and that's why I video record people. You should look at yourself and is it genuine, but it does it project certainty or a sense of surety, if you will.
So if I'm selling, for example, which means I'm trying to persuade and convince somebody or and which we do all the time, not just selling, but trying to influence somebody, then if I come across as ambivalent, uncertain, unsure, that undermines me.
Yes. And even if you don't have a definitive answer, you know, you might say, Duff, to me, what's your opinion on this? Well, Duff, this is my best view, 80% option A, 20% option B. Mm-hmm. But your manner of delivery still has an element of certainty.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. So it's not just overt bullshitting. I really don't believe this, but I'm going to try and persuade Michael of this. It's actually, okay, I've done my thinking. I've done my analysis. Here's the best recommendation. I'm persuaded and convinced of it. Now, let's see if I can persuade and convince you of it.
Yeah, I think perceived genuine energy and certainty sells. So if you perceive me as genuinely energetic or enthused about this idea, you want to buy some of it. Mm-hmm. But the genuine is important.
Yeah. Okay. Good point. Point 10, simplicity sells.
This comes, when in doubt, strike it out. If a sentence doesn't advance the case, drop it. This comes from luminary speaker, former Premier of New South Wales, Bob Carr. And most people say too much. Complexity confuses. What I find, in my work, I'll say, Duff, I want you to come to this one-on-one consultation to give me the first 50 to 75 seconds of a presentation. Often at the end of that 75 seconds, I'm saying, I don't get the message. What is it? Mm-hmm. And then I'll say, Duff, I think it's this. And then the person will inevitably say, yeah, that's it. And then I'll say, why didn't you say that? Words matter, Duff. How many words you say matters. Mm-hmm. How you sequence the words matters. Mm-hmm. For example, I could say to you, for the success of this project, your support is crucial. It's much more powerful to say your support is crucial for the success of this project. Mm-hmm. So don't start with a phrase. And you know the famous Thomas Paine statement, American Revolutionary?
Yeah.
These are the times that try men's souls. Mm-hmm. He didn't say trying times are these for men. And all the other variations, that order of words is why we remember it 200 plus years later.
And there's a guy who made his life writing propaganda in the positive sense of the word. He was a famed pamphleteer. Well, I mean, he moved people. So, I mean, you're quite right. You know, speaking as a writer, what you say matters, how many words you use, how you say it, all that matters. And you know, if there is a doubt, strike it out. One thing you learn when you're presenting, no, actually, why don't people do it? Well, I think you just illustrated, because they, as they say in the newspaper business, they bury the lead. They don't, the most important thing in a newspaper column goes right up front in the first paragraph of the first sentence, because they want the reader to get it. And a lot of people don't do that because they don't know what the lead is. They don't know what their point is.
And they haven't made the effort beforehand to distill all those amorphous ideas into simple language. And this is an important point for younger people. The biggest complaint of senior people, of junior people, when they're presenting, they give too much how, not what. This is how we did this. We did all the studies. I don't want to know that. Tell me what you want. Tell me simply, project energy and certainty, answer questions about it, see you later.
Yeah, and hurry the hell up would be my
And then they'll invite you back because you haven't wasted their time.
But you know, you're right, because so many people, I won't just say young people, but I guess they're prone to it, but I see it everywhere. The writer, the speaker, the whoever's delivering the messages, they simply won't take the time to exert themselves mentally, psychologically, emotionally, whatever, physically, to do the thinking, to pare the message down so that it resonates with the audience. And that's why they need to hire you, so they won't have to do any of the thinking, and they can just let you, they can pay you and you can do it for them.
Well, I help them do it. This is a one thing I mentioned to my clients, just thought of this. The higher you present to, the less you say, inversely proportional. Mm-hmm. So just, you know, one of my clients, it's Commonwealth Bank, he's retired, John O'Donnell, says one of the problems people make with presenting, they don't size the audience right. Do the measurement. What's this audience? What do they want to hear? Mm-hmm. Why am I here? Mm-hmm. What do they need to hear? What they do they don't need to hear? Mm. Yeah, but I think, you know, that comes back to energy. I think energy, to put the energy before you start to present, and people appreciate that, that you've done the work. Even if you, you know, younger people, it can be intimidating in boardrooms. It can be intimidating leadership teams, but they will appreciate being concise, simple, projected with energy mm-hmm. and certainty.
You know, my experience with the fewer, the more senior you are, the fewer the words. As you know, I've done a lot of, I've hosted a lot of conferences, events and things. And the more senior the person is, the briefer is the introduction. For example, I mean, the PR people send me pages and pages of stuff. And I just, you know, edit out, because I don't have all, when I'm introducing somebody, I don't have all the time in the world. But the really simple ones are, ladies and gentlemen, the Prime Minister of Australia. I mean, says it all. You know, I don't need to know what his apprenticeship was back then. And so the more senior you are, the fewer words are required to communicate. Mm. And then that applies to writing, speaking, to if I understand you correctly.
Mm, that's true. I agree.
Michael, we have an international audience of rising leaders. They desperately need your help. How do they contact you?
Sure. Very simple. As you see on the wall here, michaelkelly.com.au. And that's my website that has everything. I've written over 500 plus blog posts. I've analyzed, for example, Master Speaker Barack Obama 10, 15 times. So I think one of my clients said this, my breakdown of after someone speaks of where they need to improve is that's my skill. Someone will say something and I'll be able to identify the two top areas they need to work on first. Mm-hmm. That's michaelkelly.com.au.
And do you give free consultations to people who don't know if they need your service, but they contact you?
This is what I do. If on the phone, 15 minutes or so, happy to talk to anyone. If someone comes to North Sydney in Australia, it fits into my timetable, buys me a coffee nearby, I'll give them 30 minutes or so and give them everything I know in that time that I believe that can help them.
Yeah, you're a generous guy. You're a generous guy. I will say there's about 2 million testimonials on your website. So, I mean, if you've got the time, you can go read those, you know, if you want. So we'll finish here today. We've been speaking with Michael Kelly of Michael Kelly Communications Services. And you are listening to the international podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn. Today's podcast has been produced by Robert Hosry and is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum. PDF provides webinars, social media discussions, podcasts, parties, everything. And they're on, you can find them on the website, professionaldevelopmentforum.org. And best of all, it's free, all free. So we'll finish here today. Thank you for listening to us. Please join us on the next episode of 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, Shortcuts to Excellence for the Next Generation of Leaders.